Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk, and we're going to talk to a mystery author tonight. She's a veteran of the mystery field. She has written her 14th Duncan Kincaid book. It's called No Mark Upon Her. It is just out from Harper, and she's here to talk about it. Hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
Did I get that name? Yeah, Duncan Kincaid. I thought I had the name wrong for a second there. It's funny you say a name, and all of a sudden it doesn't sound quite right.
Duncan Kincaid and Gemma James. Gemma James. Soft G.
Well, this book was really amazing. I read it in the last 2 days, and I was up late reading it because I was doing this interview tonight, and I wanted to have it all read by the time I did the interview. And I was just amazed at how interesting the book really is.
Thank you. I obviously had a lot of fun writing it. Learned all kinds of fun and interesting things. I tend to dive into things that I don't really know very much about, and which can kind of get me in hot water usually about halfway through a book, and I think, oh my gosh, why did I think I could write about this? But this one was huge fun.
Yeah, but nobody would know that. When they read this book, they think you knew everything about rowing, because there's so much in here about rowing.
I learned a lot. You should see the stack of books on my desk, which is literally about a foot and a half high, but not just research books. I actually went to Henley-on-Thames, three or four times, and I stayed at Leander Club, where a lot of the book is set. And I met rowers, and I learned about rowing, and I talked about rowing, and I actually got to row.
Oh, you actually did row. I was going to ask you that. Did you actually get to row?
I did, and it's kind of a fun story. I had made friends with the staff at Leander Club, and I think this is the second time that I went to stay. And for people who don't know, Henley-on-Thames is the rowing capital of at least Great Britain, if not the world. And Leander Club in Henley is the most famous rowing club in the world. They've produced 99 Olympic gold medalists.
Wow.
Since the club was founded in the 1870s, I think, and it's where Team GB, Team Great Britain, trains for the Olympics. And so it's really a very elite deal. And so the second time I went to stay, I was waiting for my friend, who's one of the duty managers, to get off. And the bar and the dining room were empty, and she was cashing out, and this tall, handsome, really tall guy stuck his head in the door and said, hi, I'm here to check my mail. And she said, oh, come in and meet my friend Deborah Crombie. She's a crime writer. She's American. She's writing about rowing, and, this happens and this happens. And came in, and he said, really? And he started asking me all these questions about my rower and what her background was and what she was trying to do, which is make a comeback at 35 in the Olympic trials, and where the incident that happens in the book happens, and what time of day it is, and all this kind of stuff. And 2 hours later, we were still talking, and somewhere towards the end of this conversation, I said, I wish I knew what it felt like to row. I wasn't fishing, I really wasn't, because I'm the most unathletic person imaginable. And he said, well, I'll take you out if you want. And I said, oh, gosh, that would be nice. And we made arrangements, and we said goodnight. And then my friend came over to me and shook me by the shoulders when he left and said, do you know who that was? And I said, no. And she said, that was Stevie Williams. And I said, oh, not knowing nearly as much about rowing as I do now. And she said, that would be Sir Steve Williams, OBE, two-time Olympic gold medalist.
Wow.
I said, oh, my gosh.
So what was more fun, actually rowing with it, getting to row, or writing the book?
I think getting to row. I think being taken out, and Stevie Williams took me out in a double scull. And for those who don't know, sculling is two oars and rowing is one.
Ah, okay.
Took me out on the Thames at the time of day, when it was the time of year that the book is set. So he took me out the time of day that this, really big rowing scene in the beginning of the book happens.
Mm-hmm.
And he took me out for about 2 hours. And I think it was probably the most scary and amazing thing I have ever done in my life. It was just absolutely fantastic. And I did really understand at the end of that, you know, at least have an inkling of what it feels like to row and, you know, to move a boat like that through the water. Just really amazingly fun.
And this is the 14th in the series, and I'm absolutely amazed. This book is really very, very interesting. When I started reading it, I thought, oh, I hope it's just not a part of the series, and it's just, you know. But there's just so much fascinating stuff in this book, and the way the characters interact is really, you really have a knack for doing that.
Even though it's the 14th book in the series, I always try really, you know, obviously there's stuff that happens, you know, in the story arc of the continuing characters, because they have changed and a lot of things have happened, you know, as their lives have evolved and their family and relationships. But I always try to write every book so that it can be read as a standalone. And it sounds like I succeeded. If you came into this and maybe having read a previous book some time ago, but not feeling like you didn't know what was going on, or, you know, there was stuff you were missing that you needed to know in order to enjoy the book.
Now, isn't your first time on the New York Times best-selling list, is it?
The previous book, Necessary as Blood, made the extended list at, I think, 34.
So this is your best-selling book so far, it looks like.
This is by far my best-selling book so far. It was number 12 on the New York Times list and number 10 on the Washington Post list, and it's just had huge, huge buzz. It's been really gratifying and exciting. Well, there's not much that beats getting a call or an email that says you made the New York Times bestseller list.
I must say, reading the book, all I can think of is how jealous I am of the fact that you really know how to write. I mean, you really have the skill to do it, and you do it so well that it, you know, before you know it, half the book's done, and you're so much into the story, there's no way you could stop reading it.
That's what we all try to do, I think.
But it's a very hard. It's not easy to do, though.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say the trick is to make it look easy.
I mean, how many books do we open and we get 50 pages in and we're bored already, you know? This book's not boring at all.
Yeah, there are a lot that I get 5 pages in, and, you know, I don't have much patience. But I have a friend who usually reads my manuscripts in draft, and I think the last book there was a review that talked about Crombie's effortless prose, and we just completely cracked up because she knows, you know, I rewrite and I rewrite and I rewrite and I rewrite.
Well, it works. Whatever you're doing, it's working.
The trick is to make it look easy, to make it sound easy.
And when you think about it, I mean, having an idea and writing a book are two different things. I mean, you can have plenty of ideas, but actually turning that idea into a plausible, interesting, and fascinating book is not an easy task.
Well, I tend to write complicated books with multiple storylines and multiple viewpoints, and so I kind of throw together a bunch of ideas. It's like, think of it as idea soup. Think, oh, that would be fun, and that would be fun, and that would be fun, and I wonder how I can put all these things together. And, you know, and then I start, and I actually do a lot of plotting and outlining ahead of time. But I'm never quite sure if I can pull it off, you know, if all the threads are actually going to come together and make sense, and not only logical sense in terms of the plot, but emotional sense in terms of the characters. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Your definite plot. One of the definite pluses of your books is the characters. I mean, you have wonderful characters. You have very believable characters, and we feel like we know Duncan Kincaid even after just reading this book. And it's been a while since I read one before, but I just feel like I know these characters, and I'm watching them. It's like watching a play. You know, you're just so enjoying it. And before you know it, you're well into the story. You can't wait to see what's going to happen next. And I mean, and when you call them crime novels, I call it a mystery, but I guess, what is it really? I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I think we say crime novels because we think it sounds a little more sophisticated.
But it's interesting how things are, the crime is happening while Duncan and Gemma are trying to take care of their children. I mean, I love that. There's a domestic scene, and all of a sudden something happens with the crime.
And I don't know if there's any. Well, I can think of maybe a couple of other series crime novels that have a domestic element, and it's fun because they seem like real people to me, and they're dealing with stuff that everyday stuff that we all deal with, and they're also trying to do a really good job at their jobs. And the last couple of books have been a little bit more from Gemma's viewpoint because of the way those particular stories were structured. And this book, I think, goes back a little more into Duncan's viewpoint, which I really, really enjoyed writing. And it's fun, with the two protagonists, because I don't get bored. I get to kind of switch back and forth, and
that is it's very effective too. It because we go from one scene to the next, and it flows so nicely together. I mean, and we know we're going to come back. You stop at a pivotal scene or a pivotal moment in the story, and then you come back to it. And it's cool the way you do that. I really enjoy that.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of a learned skill. And it's something that I consciously work at. And it's funny, when I'm outlining, I'll write a scene where, something will happen, or if it's a Duncan or Jenna scene where, they go and they find out something. And because, in a crime novel, in a mystery, there's always this progression of things that your characters need to learn. And then when I'm actually writing the scene, I get to a point and all of a sudden it stops. And I call it's where the scene breaks, and you know that the scene has to stop there, and you have to pick up the action in the next scene that goes back to that viewpoint. Because if you don't, you get what I kind of think of, and Benny had ice cream and went home to bed syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
where you lose all your dramatic tension if you tell too much. So, and it's just this kind of feeling, and I'll be writing a scene and all of a sudden I'll write the sentence and it's not where I thought the scene was going to end, but I write that sentence and all of a sudden I say, okay, that's it. And then you have to pick up again. So my outlines have to be fluid because they never work out the way I think they're going to.
Now, how do these books sell in England?
Sorry?
How do your books sell in England?
They are well received. They've been very well reviewed, and I have a good fan base there. But compared to just the volume of sales in the U.S., it's not as much. The market in England is just really tough.
Yeah, I would guess. Now, you were, from what I read online, you were pretty much of a loner growing up.
Which I think, in a lot of times, is a benefit to a writer. Gives kids a chance to develop a lot of.
Were you writing even at that age? I mean, what age are we talking about when you really were kind of a loner?
Oh gosh, from the time I was like in preschool, because I sort of grew up in the country and my parents worked and my grandmother stayed home with me and. And my brother's 10 years older than I am, so, by the time I was 7 years old, he was gone.
Wow.
And so I just, I spent a lot of time, I like to joke that I was a kindergarten dropout. My parents took me to private kindergarten when I was 5 because they thought I needed some socialization. And, I cried nonstop for 2 weeks until they let me come home. Because I wanted to read books, and I had this very, very rich imaginative life. I don't know that, I didn't think of it as telling stories, but if I look back on it now, I think I did. I actually started writing when I was probably 13 or 14, but
That's
it was poetry and short stories.
That's terrific. I mean, and all the talent you've got. I mean, you wonder, you know, it's I wish I had been writing when I was younger like that. Do you think that, that you were born to write? Eventually?
It's a really interesting question.
You're very humble about it.
I think almost anybody can learn to be a storyteller, and it's funny because, you know, I started writing poetry and, you know, sort of New Yorkerish short stories that didn't have much of a plot. But I never thought of myself as a storyteller. I certainly never imagined myself as a novelist. And when I wrote the first book in the series, I just had an idea for a setting. I had an idea for a character, characters, and I started putting it together. And I thought, okay, well, you know, we need to have a plot, and just kind of put it together piece by piece. And you know, and you learn that. You learn to sort of say, well, what if? So if this happened, then you know, then what would happen after that? What would happen after that? And you know, you take things that you hear or you see, and you figure out how to make a story. And, you know, I think you can teach people to do that. But the feeling for language, I don't know if that comes from reading early and reading a lot, or if it's just something innate, like some people are really good with numbers or music, you know, which I'm completely deficient in either one of those things, completely.
You're a very humble person, which is refreshing, actually. I mean, it's easy, you become a New York Times bestselling author, it would be very easy to become full of yourself, and I can tell you're not that way. But I mean, you know, you must know you have talent.
I do. I mean, I like my books, and I think it's a nice thing to say after, you know, 20 years. And I've been thinking about this a lot because I sold my first book in February of 1992. So, you know, 20 years from sale of the first book to making the New York Times bestseller list. So,
and one of your books was one of the 100. What's the 100 of the century?
Yeah, independent mystery booksellers a few years ago did. A book that they called the 100 Best Mysteries of the Century, I think. And, of course, that book was published in 1997, so it fit into the century, the last one. But, yeah, Dreaming of the Bones, and that was it was an Edgar nominee, and it was a New York Times notable book. And so it had a lot of critical acclaim. I don't think I've ever had a book that hasn't been well-reviewed, but that one was particularly well received. But it's, you know, I figure I'm lucky to have been doing this as long as I have, and to have had as much success as I have, and to still like doing it. Because I know a lot of people who, especially who write series novels, who get bored with them, and who are obviously bored with them.
Well, how do you stop from getting bored? I mean, what do you do to keep from getting bored? Is there something you do, or is it just you try to make them as interesting as you can, and that's what keeps the boredom away?
I think part of it has to do with the nature of the series, for a lot of different reasons, partly because they're set in the UK, and I started, you know, obviously I am not British, but I write books that are set in England, and all my characters are British.
How often do you go to England?
I usually two or three times a year. But I had, when I first started writing these books, my ex-husband was Scottish, and I had lived in England and Scotland, and we were back in the States, and I was so homesick for England. Hmm. And we had been on a vacation holiday, as you say, if you're British, and in Yorkshire, and I got this idea for the first book in the series, and when I came back, I started writing it, and I think it was kind of a way to be in England in my imagination. And it still works for me, because I still feel that way about Britain. You know, I love where I live in Texas, but I just, when I go to England, when I go to Britain, I feel like I've come home. So, you know, so there's always that sense, and then there's the fact that I've got two main protagonists, I change settings. I get to change viewpoints and, you know, sort of the emphasis of the story between my two main characters. And then because all the novels are multiple storyline, multiple viewpoints, so I write from other characters' viewpoints as well. So, you know, and I write about all different things. I was a big Dick Francis fan when I was growing up. My dad, that was my, Dick Francis was my dad's favorite writer. And he loved horse racing. But that was one of the fun things that Dick Francis did, besides being a great storyteller, is, you know, he and his wife, Mary, who did all the research with him, found things that they were interested in, and they, you know, and they went and found out about them and wrote about them. So,
well, what fun that you get to do that. I mean, you just pick a subject, and I'm going to find out everything I can find out about, in this case, rowing. But, you know,
I've done everything from, you know, Cambridge academia to the English National Opera to timeshare in Yorkshire, the tea trade, children who were evacuated from London during the Second World War, Notting Hill in the 60s, whiskey tasting, whiskey distilling in Scotland. narrow boats in the English waterways, just all kinds of really fun stuff. So, I think that really keeps it from being boring.
Absolutely, there's no doubt about it. And you know, and it's so great. I sit here in my apartment and read this book and just enjoyed it so thoroughly. I mean, just sitting here and put some music on. I love to listen to music and read a book. I don't know why, but that's always thrilling to me. I could just sit here and the pages fly by. I mean, it's such a great feeling. I mean, you can find a book like that. And we all know it. You don't find it every time you read a book. If only you could. Are you as voracious a reader now as you were back then?
Oh, yeah. And
you still cry when you can't read?
Yeah.
Do you?
I'm on a group blog called Jungle Red Writers, and actually our post, there are eight of us, we're all crime writers, and you know, we do this, we all post, but one of us is in charge every week and, you know, comes up with the ideas for the blogs, and today it was what we're reading, and my list of stuff that I have read and, you know, am in the process of reading, and you know, in the next couple of books up, I looked at that and thought, God, that's scary. You know, that means, because I don't read during the day when I'm working, and so that means I don't sleep enough. But if I don't read every day, I think it makes me crazy. So.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I know exactly how you feel. Just last week I was in the hospital for a day, and I had to take my book with me. I'm going to go nuts if I can't read in the hospital. I mean, I really would go nuts.
So do you have an e-reader, or are you?
I do, but I didn't take that. I didn't. I want a book in my hand. I'm one of the old schools. I want a book. I want to see the cover. I want to feel. And I know this sounds really creepy, but I'd love to feel the author's name on the outside of the book. And I'd love all that. I just, nothing replaces that for me. I never will.
You know, it's interesting that obviously I get a lot of feedback from readers and, you know, web page and email and Facebook. And so many people say that, and, you know, it's even people who have Kindles or Nooks or tablets or whatever, and, you know, they like it for the convenience. But there aren't very many people that seem to, you know, be willing to give up real in-the-flesh paper books. I haven't even bought, you know, you would think since it's my business that I would have some kind of an e-reader, but I don't. I have Kindle and Nook on my laptop and Kindle on my phone. But I like books.
Yeah.
I want to be able to turn the pages and, you know, it's great to have that instant gratification of just being able to download a book that sounds interesting and it's right there, you know, and you can read it right that second. But it's just, for me, scrolling on a screen is just not the same.
Absolutely. You and I have a lot in common. I feel all the same way, all the same things you said, that you feel, that I feel the same way. So, I mean, it's There's definitely, I've got this list here in front of me that the publisher sent me of all the different, all your different books, and you actually tell what, I guess it's the month of the year that each takes place in? Is that what it is?
I don't know what they sent you. I did kind of a series timeline.
Yeah, it's a timeline thing, but.
Yeah.
Is the month where the actual month that it takes place in the book?
Yeah.
That's really cool. You made this all up yourself?
Yeah, I had to go back through the books and, you know, kind of think about it. And, you know, because in what I say, the first book was published in 1993. The series time doesn't run like real time. Mm-hmm. And then this is an interesting thing, I think, for people who write series novels. And I made a decision very early on with the first book how I wanted to handle that, because there are some writers like Sue Grafton, who's kept Kinsey Millhone in the 80s.
Right.
My friend Cara Black, who with her Amy LeDuc books, do you know those?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just read the New Winning Galley, and it was great fun. But she made a decision to keep those, you know, to set those books in the 90s and to keep them. You know, they have moved forward a little bit, but to keep them in the 90s. And then I think, you know, Ian Rankin, I think, aged Rebus in real time.
Although Rebus is retired now, so he's got a new
series. Yeah, well, he had to, because he was, because the books ran in real time. And I sort of used P.D. James as my model when I started out, because the first P.D. James novel, Cover Her Face, was published in 1962.
Oh, that's the year I was born.
Yeah, and the most recent one, The Private Patient, which it's been, what, maybe, what, 2-3 years ago now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Adam Dalgleish, who's a commander now, but he's just thinking about getting remarried. And, you know, if the series had run in real time, he would have been long retired and, you know, off
right.
the old folks home.
Yeah, she has a new...
Although P.D. James is certainly not, but...
Right. Well, she had a new novel about Jane Austen, a murder mystery set.
Yeah, Death Comes to Pimperley, I read it.
Right. Did you like that?
I did. It's not, I think, and it's still, you know, in the top 10 on the New York Times bestseller list, so obviously people are buying it, but I've heard a really mixed reaction to it, you know, and people who didn't like it.
It sold really well during the holidays, which was nice.
It was my Christmas present to myself. But I think maybe it has to do with people's expectations, because if they were expecting that, you know, Darcy would be an amateur detective, he's not. You know, it's basically a novel where a crime happens.
So
it's not a mystery in a traditional sense. I mean,
right.
you do find out eventually what happened, and, you know, the mystery of the crime is solved, but it's not because the characters become amateur detectives.
Right. I must ask you about the numbers in this new book, the Marco Pano, the numbers with the rowers. What do the numbers mean, the fours and the eights? I was getting a little confused with that.
Well, we talked a little bit about sculling and rowing, so... if you scull, you have two oars, and rowers have one. So you can have a single sculler, but you can't have a single rower because the boat would just go around in circles.
Right.
Because, you'd only have the oar on one side.
Right.
So in sculling, you can have a single, you can have a double, or you can have a quad. And then in rowing, you can have a double, a four, which can either have a cox, which is the person who doesn't row but steers, or coxless. And my friend Stevie Williams took me rowing, won 2 Olympic gold medals in the coxless four. So they were 4 rowers with nobody to steer except the rowers. And then in rowing, you can have a four, and then you can have an eight, which is what, and there's a lot of stuff in the book about the Oxford-Cambridge boat race, and those are eight, so you've got 8 rowers.
Oh, I see.
And, you know, with 4 rowing on bow side and 4 rowing on stroke side. You know, I can't tell my right from my left, so all that stuff is very confusing for me.
Well, you must be doing, you're doing something right, because your books are terrific, so, We all can't be perfect, so I wouldn't worry about it. And you can always find out more things, so you're always learning things. That's a great thing. With every book, you're learning more and more about different subjects. So it's
One of the things, the other big part of No More Caponer has to do with canine search and rescue, which, and I have, you know, if you read my bio on the books or the webpage or anything, I have German Shepherds, and I'd really been interested in writing about working dogs for a long time, so I kept trying to figure out how I could, you know, what kind of working dogs they would be and how I could work this into the plot. And
you obviously and like dogs.
Yeah, and that was, that again, like the rowing, that was just enormously interesting and fun. I made friends with people in the real search and rescue group. The search and rescue, the canine search and rescue group in the book is called Tim Staley Search and Rescue, and the real search and rescue group in that area is called Berkshire Search and Rescue, Berkshire SAR. And I made friends with folks at Berkshire SAR, and I got to go out on training exercises, which basically means, you know, you go out in the dark and you tromp around in muddy fields and hide in bushes, so come and find you.
I like the way in your book also you make these little hints. Like there's one point in the book where you talk about Melody maybe meeting this guy later in the future, in a future book. Maybe there's something going to develop between Melody and this guy. I wrote LR here. I don't know why I wrote LR. Must have been the character's name.
Oh, I think I think there's a little hint there, something about a character from a previous book named Lucas Ritchie, but that's not happening in the book I'm writing. Melody does meet somebody, but it's not Lucas Ritchie.
Ah, that's in it. That's why I wrote LR. I was wondering why I put LR. I'm like, doesn't sound like somebody's in, you know.
I'm usually planting little seeds of things a couple of books ahead, but they don't always work out the way I think they're going to.
And you also mentioned something with Duncan Kincaid's partner, too, where he goes in the bar and he sees this woman, and he's like, well, if under some other circumstances, I'd like to take her out for a drink. So
I'm trying to remember which cat. I think it's Lily, who's the manager of the club, of Leander Club, the fictional manager of Leander Club.
Right. Well, who's Duncan's partner? I can't remember his name now.
I say it's Doug Cullen.
Cullen.
Yeah, Doug Cullen.
So I started to think, well, she's throwing these things out. She's going to put them in later books, and I can't wait to read them. See how they make out on their dates, you know? But obviously, that's not the case, though.
Well, there are really interesting things that happen to Doug and Melody both in the book that is in progress right now. But it has to do with rock and roll guitar and all kinds of different things. Although I haven't learned to play guitar for this book, but I know a whole lot more about guitars than I did when I started. And this one should have a soundtrack when it's finished.
Soundtrack?
It would be fun, wouldn't it, to be able to...
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because Jodi Picoult did that with one of her books. She had each chapter was a different song.
I think Deb Harkness. Have you interviewed Deborah Harkness?
No, I'm going to meet her. I haven't read yet. I've started it. I'm going to read it at some point.
Oh, it's fabulous. That was one of my favorite books, finds of last year.
Oh, really?
But I think she's kind of done a soundtrack for her characters, Matthew and Diana. You know, music that fits in with the book. So the one I'm working on, because it has to do with a guitar player and a girl singer, it would be fun to have some soundtrack stuff.
So what are you like when you're writing a book? Are you real irritable? Do you have trouble sleeping?
I do get a little bit irritable when I don't get to finish, when my writing time gets interrupted, or I can't get to it because I have to do other stuff. And I don't sleep very well when I get really... because I'm a night person.
Right.
You know, there are all these writers who say they get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I always say, well, why do they get to sound so self-righteous? Because they get up and write at 4 o'clock in the morning, where if I said I stayed up and wrote until 4 o'clock in the morning, nobody would think that that was a great self-sacrifice.
Do you sometimes fall asleep in the middle of writing?
No. What happens? Well, sometimes in the mornings I will, because my brain just doesn't function as well, and I'll get sleepy. But what happens at night? And I'll be writing, and a lot of times I'll go back to work after dinner, and then I'll take a bath or something. And there's something about 11 o'clock at night that my brain just kicks into high gear, and I call it the cosmic download. And all of a sudden, you start getting big chunks of scenes and dialogue, and you know exactly what's supposed to happen and what the characters say, and I keep a pen and a notebook by the bed, because I've discovered if I don't write this stuff down, you lose it.
Right.
It's like Coleridge and the person from Porlock, where you just get that all in one, you get it all in one big lump. And I've discovered over the years, unfortunately, that if you think, oh, okay, I'll remember this in the morning, that it's never the same.
Mm-hmm.
You may remember the sort of general outline of it, but you know, whatever it is that makes it so clear and so real, you don't get back. And so a lot of times I will stay up and write, and then, even if I just made notes and, I think I've got enough down that I can put it on paper and get it right the next morning, a lot of times I just don't sleep very well, because my brain is still... If I could live my writing life on my own terms, I'd probably stay up really late.
It doesn't show in the writing, that's for sure, because when you read the book, it's just, everything's very clear and precise. You can tell you've worked hard on this book. I mean, the effort shows, is what I'm saying.
Well, I really appreciate that, because, I think that...
Well, I get, believe me...
The great cross in my writing career has been that I don't write faster. 14 books in 20 years is not a terrific output. But it just takes me... there's the logistics of it, because sometimes I just get stuck and I need to go back to England.
Wrong? Does anybody expect you to have 20 books in 20 years?
Yeah. My publishers.
But you can only look at Nelson DeMille, and it takes 2 or 3 years to write a book, and nobody ever complains about him. he writes long books. Even a lot longer than yours. To some extent, I think his are like 400 or 500 pages at least.
You know what's funny is that I think the first book in the series, at least, and the first couple were a little bit longer, but the first book in the series was about half the length that they are now. That I'm still expected to do a book a year, but I think I figured out on average it takes me somewhere between about 15 and 18 months.
Well, are you disappointed in yourself if you don't do a book a year?
Yeah. I always think if I was more organized, because I think my books are very organized, because I do spend all that time plotting and trying to make sure that all the storylines work and they're believable, but I'm not very organized in my personal life.
I think that's true of a lot of people. Some people act like they're really organized, but nobody can be completely organized, can they?
I don't know. I always think that other people are.
Yeah, well, that's because it seems that way, because maybe they could be organized, but I think people aren't as organized as they pretend sometimes.
Oh, I don't know. I know a lot of writers who are tremendously more organized than I am.
I mean, Nora Roberts is going to publish her 200th book in a couple of months, and I don't know how.
I don't think Nora Roberts is human, and I mean that in the nicest way.
Oh boy, I hope she's not listening.
Maybe I should say superhuman, because most people just can't. I don't think, and actually, I try to keep. One of my favorite writing quotes is from Nora Roberts, who said, somewhere other than bad pages are better than no pages, which is probably the truest thing that anybody ever said about writing, because, if you've written bad pages, you have something and you can go back and fix them, and if you haven't written any pages, you have no pages.
She must write 20 or 30 a day. I can't even imagine how many pages she writes.
I don't know how somebody can type that much every day. You know,
maybe she has a secretary. I don't know.
I have carpal tunnel.
Yeah, really. That's there's a point to that.
Five or six pages a day is a really good writing day for me.
Well, I mean, could you, if you had to, could you dictate to somebody else?
No.
It wouldn't be the same?
No, there's something about actually seeing the words go down on the paper or on the screen. And I edit constantly as I write.
Right.
And it probably has something to do with, you know, whether you're an audio person, is that the right term, or a visual person. Because I know there are writers who dictate.
But all these 14 books, have some of them been harder to write than others? I mean, in the scheme of things, how Noamar Kapaner, how hard was that compared to the other ones?
Oh, gosh. I'll have to think about that. Dreaming of the Bones was really hard to write for emotional reasons because of the things that happen in that book.
Well, Noamar Kapaner is pretty emotional, too. Some really emotional scenes.
Yeah.
With the family that I enjoyed. I really enjoyed it. And they have, and Charlotte is, now Charlotte was born where?
Charlotte, who's their little girl that they are fostering in this book. She is almost three. She actually turns three in this book. She was born in London. She was born in East London.
I have to go back and read the book before where that happens. Isn't the book before where that happens?
Yeah, it's the book before. And Charlotte's mixed race. She's kind of a melting pot kid. And
going to have an interesting life for sure.
Yeah, and it's obviously because they have, for those who don't know the background of characters, they have now a blended family, and they each have a son from previous relationships or marriages, and the kid's 14 and Toby's 6, and now they have a 3-year-old, and so, you know, everybody's lives have to be juggled around bringing a new child into the family and a child who's been through, you know, really traumatic experiences, so... it is, and actually, on emotional terms, that book, Necessary as Blood, was emotionally difficult, too. I don't know.
Was that a good thing that it's emotionally, is it a good thing that it's an emotionally difficult book, or does it really drain you?
Well, both.
I often wonder when I see a good acting job, like acting in movies and TV, when they're screaming at the top of the lungs. I mean, I think to myself, well, that must be very stressful for their heart, because they really convince you that they're really upset.
Well, especially when you think that they've done like 30 takes.
Exactly. I mean, I just talked to the niece of the Downton Abbey thing, her book that just came out about Downton Abbey, and she says one of the dinner scenes takes 10 to 12 hours to film.
I read that because I'm a huge Downton Abbey fan. In fact, I just ordered the... Was it the Lady Almina? Is that...
The book, yes. Yes, I've seen
that. Yeah, because I actually just ordered that today because it was a treat to myself because I've really been wanting to read it.
But you talk about a 10-minute scene taking 10 to 12 hours. That's a long time. That's a long day. And they say the trick is that the actors can't even eat because if they eat, they've got to eat in every take.
Yeah.
And by the time...
Yeah. Fiddling with wine glasses.
Even though we're sitting at home getting hungry, watching the meat, thinking, well, they're so lucky they get to eat free food. You know, they get free food, and when in actuality they can't eat it. And if you watch it, you'll see that they don't eat much. So, but you got to.
It's kind of like, you know, you sit down and you read a 4-page scene in a book in a couple of minutes, and you know it may have taken the writer or me, you know, 2 days. If it's a really tough scene, and you know, you consider writing and rewriting. And
well, you talk about being kind of disorganized. Does that bother you that you are? Do you wish you were more organized?
Oh yeah, doesn't everybody?
I don't know. I think some people are disorganized and don't care.
Well, yeah, that's probably true. No, I wish I was.
I look at it this way. I look at it this way. To be totally organized and to get everything right, and it takes a lot of effort. Now, I don't even know if I have that much in me to be able to do that every day. I mean, there's people that get up at the same time every day, do the same things. I'm one of those people who gets up in the morning and likes to do different things. I mean, I love doing different things. I'm not one of these creatures that likes to do the same things at the same time. I mean, my dad was like that. He'd just do the same thing at the same time every day.
David, you made me feel so much better. So it doesn't matter that, you know, because my writing office is separate from, like, you know, the bookkeeping and the paperwork, you know, bill paying and all that stuff. I have a basket of stuff that nothing has been filed for a year.
I know the feeling. I've got some of that, too. We'll have to compare notes one day.
And then, obviously, it doesn't, you know, bother me enough to get it done.
But I'm jealous of you because you have such wonderful writing talent. I mean, you can tell such a great story, and every time you do it, every time with every book. I mean, and I think.
Oh, I hope so. Knock wood.
And like reading No Mark Upon Her, I'm thinking, wow, I can't wait to go back and read the other ones to see if they're just as good as this one. I love this book, and I really did. I'm not just saying that because I'm talking to you. I really did enjoy this tremendously.
I have a lot of really nice feedback from people who haven't read the series before who have said, oh, you know, I want to go back and read all the... And right. I think you can. I mean, a lot of people come into the series, and then if they like the characters, and then they want to go back and read the previous books. And it's fun to read them in order so you can kind of see how things develop over the course of the series. But, you know, one of the interesting things about this writing journey and, you know, 14 books and 20 years has been that I don't think it gets easier. It doesn't. Some technical things are easier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just use of language and, you know, all the stuff that you learn that you start to take for granted, how to structure a manuscript and, you know, how to structure scenes and organize your material and stuff like that.
And I must say that...
I don't think writing actually gets easier.
And I must say, at the beginning of each chapter, there's a quote by different... That they were really fascinating to read. I don't know where you found all those, but
well,
they're from...
That's what the foot and a half high stack of research books, which I have for almost every book I've written. For the one I'm working on now, I've read a lot of...
So do you have to get permission to put those quotes, these quotes in there?
Generally, they're short enough that the publisher decides that they fall under fair usage.
Oh, okay.
You know, because it's just little excerpts. But I think in this book, and some of the quotes have to do with canine search and rescue, but I think the majority of them are about rowing. And I think, although, you know, obviously we do have competitive rowing in the U.S., and, you know, particularly on the East Coast and West Coast, and I think Michigan is very big. And so it's not that we don't know, you know, that people don't know about rowing, but it's not as big a part of the, you know, sort of cultural atmosphere as it is in Britain. So I think it's really fun because it's kind of my writer's cheat to get to use some of all this research material that I've read.
And I wonder why they haven't.
You can't put all that into the actual story, or it would bore people to death. But,
yeah.
You know, if you can put these little descriptive quotes at the beginning of the chapter, they kind of set things up, or they, you know, they tell readers things that they wouldn't know.
Right.
That's what's happening, and I actually work really hard on those. So, you know, trying to find just the right bit and make sure it goes in the right place.
That's great, and that's extra work for you, but you must enjoy it at some point too.
Yeah, and the book I'm working on now, I'm kind of doing differently because I have previously done the chapter quotes as I went along, and this one I decided I was just going to write straight through the book and do them at the end.
Well, I hope it's got as many wonderful scenes as this one had in it.
I hope so. It's fun so far. I'm liking it a lot. But I'm still at the point where I hope I can make everything.
And why haven't we seen anything on any kind of a series based on your books? Why have they not asked you? Or are you not letting them do it, or what?
Oh no, I would love to see it done and done well. That's kind of a scary thing about TV adaptation is, most writers give up. And, unless they can afford to produce them themselves, most writers give up.
I kind of picture Duncan as maybe Liam Neeson or something, a younger Liam Neeson or something.
Well, maybe. I can never quite cast my characters. I'm always looking. I'm always watching because I watch, British movies and I watch a lot of British television. And so I'm always looking for actors who might play the parts that, there's nobody that I could just absolutely put my finger on. I would love, that's what I have always hoped would happen for the books. I would love to see them done for British television. I think they would be.
I can't believe you haven't been approached.
Hugely. Well, I have, but TV is kind of a crazy business, and you'll have people that, all of a sudden they come up and they contact you and they say, oh my gosh, this is just the best thing, and it'll make the most brilliant television ever, and they want to have meetings and do this and that and do options, and then they drop off the face of the earth, and you never know what happened. So there's been several things, and there's some talk going on at the moment, but it's not something that I'm holding my breath.
Well, that's the thing. The bottom line is still that, the enjoyment you get out of reading this series is all in your imagination. And maybe, as much as I'd love to see them on TV too, maybe, it would be like a V.I. Warshawski. Maybe they wouldn't do a good job with it. And, maybe it might dull the excitement of reading the books. Because I find that happens sometimes when I read a book that a series that I've loved so much, when you actually see it on the screen, it's sometimes so much of a shock if it's so different.
It depends. There are TV adaptations that I've actually liked better than the books.
People were very upset about Linley and Havers because they weren't anything like the characters in the book. But you know what? I loved every minute of those TV shows.
Loved them. I like those, and I love Colin Dexter. I've known Colin for years, and he's an absolute sweetheart. But I love the books, but I actually like the TV series better. And I love the spinoffs. I love Lewis.
You'll have to tell me.
I like better than Morse.
Yeah, I agree with you. I like Lewis too. I think, and I love his partner too.
That's a big part of it.
There's something about him that I really, really enjoy.
Yeah, Laura. That's on my wish list is to go back and get the DVDs of the first series and rewatch it because I was a little unsure. I always really liked Kevin Whately, who plays Lewis, but I wasn't sure about Lawrence Fox, and he's just brilliant.
Somehow they always get the right actors. I don't know how they do it. Whoever casts in England does a fantastic job.
So it would be really fun. I would love to see that happen and, be done well, and I just think it would be. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. They certainly have a body of work.
Right. Now, do you have a title for the next book yet?
I do, but I'm not sure it's official.
Oh, so you can't even give us a little bit of a hint? Give my readers.
I can tell you a little bit about it's set in South. Part of it, at least, is set in very South London, in an area called Crystal Palace, which is it's actually the highest part of South London, and it's where the Crystal Palace of the Great Exhibition of 1851, which was put up in Hyde Park, was taken down and reassembled on Sydenham Hill. And
but you're afraid the title might change, though.
Yeah, which is now Crystal Palace. So part of the book is is set in Crystal Palace. But I like this. It has a working title, and I like it. But I think my editor likes it. But until she says it's, you know, an absolute definite official title, I probably should keep it to myself.
Oh, boy. Now my readers are all, like, very upset because they don't know. And I wish I knew, too.
I'll have to ask my editor if she thinks it's good to go. Now that No Mark Upon Her is out, it would be nice to have, you know, the title for the next book. I have to be really, really careful, though, you know, in case I call it something and then the title changes.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it'll go out onto the Internet, and then there'll be this book that people will be trying to find that never exists.
Exactly, and they'll think they missed one. Oh, and readers don't like that at all. They're like, what happened to that book? Why wasn't it ever published?
Yeah, well, I have been lucky. I've gotten to keep most of my titles, so.
Well, I think it's interesting. It's very telling that you say you like all your books, and I think that's really, I don't hear that very often, that a writer will tell me, I really love all my books. You know, they don't ever come out right out and say that. I think that's very interesting that you did.
I do. I really like listening to, it's actually hard for me to go back and really read them for some reason. I don't know, maybe it's because, you know, as writers, we read them so many times. In process, I mean, not only in writing, but then in revisions, and then in copy edit, and then in page proofs, and I do it, you know, for the U.S., and I have done it for both the U.S. and the U.K., and all these versions, but I love listening to the audio and the narration by Michael Behe, who's actually his, that's a pseudonym, he's actually Gerard Doyle. And he's a great narrator. And I, you know, if I listen to his audio versions of the books, they just, it's funny because I know I've written this story and I know what happens, but when I listen to them, when I listen to Gerard read them, I get so sucked into it. It's like,
that's great.
Wait, I have to see what happens next.
Some writers will say to me, why did I write like that? Why did I put that word in there? Why, that sounds weirder, but you don't.
Well, you can. I mean, you can go back and pick apart sentence to sentence, but, and I can see how I've evolved as a writer, and I can see, you know, the books are more complex and the characters are more complex. But if I go back and you know, read or listen to those early books, I like the voice, I like the language, I like the characters, I like the stories. I still think the prologue to the third book in the series, which is actually set partly in Henley, where Miss Mark Upon Her is set, but Leave the Grave Green, I think the prologue of that book is one of the best things I've ever written.
No, I'll have to read it.
That was like 1995. I mean, I can't read that without.
Well, one thing I know for sure, you really know what you're doing. You really are a very talented writer. I know that for certain.
Thank you so much. That would be hugely comforting to me when I sit down at the computer at 10 o'clock tonight and look at this scene I'm struggling with. And
right.
Think, oh.
But you know what? I know you're going to figure it out. Because you have those moments, but they pass, and you'll just be fine. And look at your body of work now, 14 books. You've done a remarkable job.
I think 15 will be tremendous.
Right. I can't wait to read it. Maybe you'll send me an early copy.
I will definitely make sure to do that.
Oh, good. Well, it's been so much fun. Well, I wish we could talk all night, but we've run out of time.
Well, it's been great talking to you.
Yeah, this has been a lot of fun. You're really a treat.
We've done this before, and it was fun then. And I hope we get to do it again. And I hope everybody who's listening enjoys the book as much as you did.
Let me remind them once more.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. The new book again is called No Mark Upon Her by Deborah Crombie, and it's in all your bookstores now. It's published by HarperCollins. And go enjoy it, and I know you will. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.